Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I had a dog growing up. Show you a picture of him. Black, white feet, white throat, little white tip on his tail. I loved that dog. That dog knew when I was going to service. He knew when I got in trouble. He knew when I was phoning home. He'd come up, lay on the porch, and look at the phone. And it'd ring if it was from me. He'd bark like wild, make sure somebody answered the phone. You know what his name was? Nigger.
And that was your dog?
That's right. I love that dog. That wasn't no bad name. That's because he was black, shiny, pretty, muscular. Come on, nigger. You see? I wasn't using it in a bad way. They were run out of town not because they were black. They were run out of Corbin because they were drinking, gambling, and raising all kinds of cane with their newfound pocket money from the railroad.
Context of white supremacy. For those who listen closely, you could hear Dixie playing in the background as it faded out. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, August 19, 2020, so I have been told. This is our book club, our fifth study session on Romaine Gary's White Dog. He will continue to jab away at Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture. That will continue on this week, 3 weeks in a row. But the audio clip we heard at the beginning, that was from the documentary film Trouble Behind, which we watched at the Cal's Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat in Washington, D.C. But where they're talking about this film is about the early 20th century purge of black people from Corbin, Kentucky. And you heard one of the suspected race soldiers talking about his hound from childhood and his reasoning for why the Negroes were purged from Corbin, Kentucky. Fascinating documentary film. You should check it out. It's about 30 years old now. Anyway, but I thought that was a great segment, his hound, Nigger, and why he was named Nigger. But that will lead us back to Romaine Gary's White Dog, again, where in the midst he's been writing about the assassination of Dr. King and the so-called rioting that's happening in Washington, D.C. and throughout North America after the assassination. We'll hear more of that, the response, the Poor People's Campaign, and as I said, him talking trash about Stokely Carmichael. That ready for revolution. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Again, the context of white supremacy. This is the book club, Romaine Gary, White Dog, audio segment 1. Chapter 15. Every time I now pay a visit to Botka, I am made to feel an intruder, an outsider, and a pain in the neck. The sort of man who sits next to a couple of lovers in a park. A beautiful friendship is in the making. As soon as Keys goes into the cage, the dog sits up on his hind legs and tries to lick his black face, then rubs himself against his legs with affectionate grunts. I watch with a tender, approving smile, smug and snug in my now confirmed belief that nothing is ever lost, that all it takes is goodwill, hard work, and patience. I am proud of myself. I have accomplished something. I stay there feeling I am receiving my reward, a prize for virtue. Botka's behavior when all three of us come together there is tactful. He rushes up to me, baring his teeth in a pleasant grin and wriggling his behind. He then indulges in his favorite joke, which is to nibble at my beard as if he were looking for the fleas it must be full of. Then, back to Keys, so as not to hurt anyone's feelings, back to me again, going through this demonstration a couple of times. A person with a writer's bent toward fiction would say he is inviting us to fraternize and to seal a pact of friendship. Well, I say in the end to Keys, during one of these visits, I think the dog is ready to go back into the world and take his place in society. He has recovered. I wouldn't bet on that. He's accepted me all right, but when Terry or another brother comes near the cage, he's at it again. He laughs, and suddenly his teeth seem to be the only thing in sight. There are good niggers and bad niggers for him now. You can't keep a dog from making a distinction between people he knows and strangers. That's normal. Sure, that's normal. But you know what isn't normal? It's that a white man's smell doesn't get him. But a black man's smell? Oh, come off it, Keys. He is squatting on his heels. He gives the dog a last friendly tap and gets up. I'm just making a technical remark. The most important thing in that kind of training with police dogs is smell. That's how the dog learns to recognize his own people. There is no trace of arrogance in his attitude. Very quiet, very matter of fact. There exists a whole literature about the excitable emotionalism of blacks. The ones I know rarely lose their cool. Some of them act as if they had been killed long ago. Are you trying to tell me something? Yeah, I think maybe you shouldn't come here too often. The dog gets confused. He doesn't quite know where and to whom he belongs. You see that in the way he keeps running from you to me. What are your plans exactly? You thinking of taking him back to Europe? I'm going to lay it on the line. The dog's taken a hell of a lot of my time. Gave me lots of trouble. I am aware of that. Now, if I've been through all this business only so that you can take the dog away, goodbye and thanks, that ain't fair. Botka is sitting between the two of us, his tail sweeping the sand. His eyes keep going from Keys to me as if he knows that his fate is being discussed. I hesitate. I feel like a man in charge of souls. I can't possibly take the dog with me on all my hops around the world, and yet I'd feel like a traitor if I told Keys, "Okay, keep him." I'm asking you a straight question. Are you going to give me the dog? I keep mum. This sudden, direct challenge, yes or no, hits upon a secret flaw, some oriental trait in my character, and I often think it comes from my Tartar ancestry. I cannot bear finality, the last decisive word, the irreversible. And add to that dislike of points of no return the strange mentality of a chief of a clan or of a tribe, again perhaps inherited from some Khan leading his golden horde. All those who are mine can never be left behind, and this even includes objects. An odd atavism which has come a long way since the days when my ancestors were buried in the Kurrounds with their most prized possessions, their falcon, their horse, and often their favorite wife. Well, What about it? The dog will be staying in America anyhow, if you really care. Sure I do. There's plenty of time. We'll talk more about it. Chapter 16. Back home, I hasten to bury myself in an entirely imaginary world. I am writing a love story. I am brought back to reality by a lovely girl I shall call Clara. She shows up with her boyfriend. I had managed to avoid her since my arrival in Hollywood. I like her very much, but she makes me feel too miserable. She's the kind of person you badly wish you could help, but cannot, and so you keep away from her. Clara had almost been a star in the movies and actually made it in a tremendously successful TV series. She is known among black extremists as a nigger lover. This stinking term, coined by whites, is now used at least as often by blacks. I sincerely believe that for some black militants, and particularly for their wives, there is no human being more despised than a white woman who goes from one black lover to another. And yet, 7 or 8 years ago, when Clara was just beginning to take an active part in the civil rights movement, sex had nothing to do with it, and I even remember a meeting when she had made that very clear and in a truly witty way. The purpose of the meeting was to raise funds, and it took place in her house in... Never mind. At that time, she was at the peak of both her looks and her professional success. A big, thin, narrow-hipped girl, a real redhead with those freckles that make women look like kids until they are close to 40. After 40, they look apologetic. There were a few whites there and about 20 blacks, men and women. Almost all of them were in African dress in that affirmation of negritude that actually goes no farther back in time than the cotton cloth manufactured in Manchester. I see no other future for this need for authenticity than rings in the nose, plates in the lips, and facial mutilations. Clara clapped her hands for silence and attention. Her speech was brief and effective. Before carrying on with the serious business at hand, let me make a remark for the benefit of some of the guys present. Every time I say no to one of them, they come up with a nice bit of analysis. Apparently, deep down, there in my subconscious, I'm still bearing the scars of my childhood in a racist environment in my sweet home state of Georgia, and that's why I can't bring myself to go to bed with a Negro. Okay, so let's have this little matter out once and for all. If one of you fellows can prove here and now that by my screwing with him I can contribute something to the civil rights struggle, well, great. Let's go upstairs. My bedroom is on the second floor. Raise your hands, please, and I'll lie down happily and produce right now. Okay? There was a general outburst of laughter, though its main purpose was to cover up a considerable amount of embarrassment. After that, serious business was discussed. If I remember the figure correctly, Clara herself signed a check for $40,000 that evening. To earn that sum, after taxes, an actress has to earn some $200,000 a year. All those who can identify the girl I am talking about know that the greater part of what she was earning went to various organizations. But you can't live and work shoulder to shoulder with men you admire for their tenacity and courage and disregard them as men, blocking off any normal relationship between man and woman. Clara finally took a black lover, then another. The fact that they were black was totally irrelevant. I don't think she even noticed at that point that they were. Living and working with people, you lose all awareness of the color of their skin. If you live in France, you don't come back home saying, "I've met a Frenchman." But there was a period in the years following the murder of Malcolm X when fanaticism in a political vacuum began to border on paranoia and imbecility like all fanaticism. That was, historically, when white liberals were first under attack from the militants, and in certain quarters, word went out to use the white sympathizers, but never to forget they were enemies. That was the beginning of gaming whitey, and it is now as dead strategically as Carmichael. Rejecting white liberals and cutting off your nose to spite your face is a form of scorpionesque self-hate that smacks of a neurotic love of tragedy for tragedy's sake, and with Leroy Jones' talent, you may get something out of it in terms of poetry, but I do not believe the black masses are after poetry right now. It is difficult for those who haven't come close to it to imagine how much hatred, vengeance, and despair a neurotic black fanatic, and let no man make me say more than I am saying here, a neurotic black fanatic bears no relation to perfectly normal black-white couples, can put into the act of laying a white woman. Cleaver has told it all admirably with reference to the rapes he himself committed. Sex is an outlet by its very nature, but there are those who have more to let out than others. Anyway, Clara was both used and abused, screwed and despised. She became a sex joke. By that, I mean that dirty smirk on a man's face behind a woman's back. With a Protestant conscience and the fundamental, though diffused, unformulated guilt that often leads to self-punishment, that is, to masochism, Clara's mental makeup gradually became twisted. She began to see herself as a kind of expiatory victim redeeming the white race and its sexual exploitation of black women. She was becoming exactly the kind of woman you find in a pathological couple when two symmetrically similar neurotics come to grips and sex becomes pathology, expiation, vengeance, sadism, all kinds of delights. She was rushing frantically toward self-destruction. Being a writer sometimes inspires certain confessions, and Clara's quotes from her love dialogues had the obscene flatness of an all-out, no-holds-barred, sadomasochistic relationship. The ideal conditions of the, "Here, take that, you white bitch," and, "Yes, darling, yes, give it to me," were realized to perfection. I am glad to see her in a rather apprehensive way. She drinks too much, and drunks are an anathema to me. She kisses me. Her thinness has become bony. There is that feverish euphoria in her enthusiastic words and quick movements that show all too clearly the effect of pep pills. She is still very attractive, but it is the kind of beauty that already announces the coming of a parched dryness of the skin, and an eye accustomed to the passage of seasons can already detect 10 years in advance the mask of a 50-year-old woman whose age is not the working of years, but of self-hatred. Her escort is a young black man in a blue blazer, very polite, pleasant, and very much at ease in his American skin. After the traditional 15 minutes of the latest police brutalities and of what they say about Ron Coringa, and they have to say a lot, there comes the painful moment when the ex-star, one of the most difficult exes to bear, begins to talk about her movie offers, the parts she has been turning down, her latest agent, the young man studies his fingernails. We are all more and more embarrassed. Jean is back from work and is listening in stricken silence. The lead in this, the lead opposite. Another drink, and another. We know, and Clara knows that we know. Yes, they have just asked her to play the lead in Paint Your Wagon, a $15 million musical, Alan J. Lerner, Lee Marvin, Josh Logan, begs her to accept. Jean looks at me in consternation. She had accepted the part in the movie 2 weeks earlier. The contract was already signed. Clara will be so hurt. The young man turns angrily toward the girl. Why don't you shut up? But, honey, he jumps up and takes away her glass. You've had enough. The lovely green eyes fill with tears. You're a bastard, such a bastard, all of you, now that I don't have any money left. He turns toward us. He is a nice guy, and it so happens that he has talent. The real thing, not just polite reviews, because he is a black writer. His first play is one of the best I have seen from the new black school of writing, which is taking over from the Jewish writers, and there is one remarkable thing about it. It is totally devoid of hate. He is only 26 years old, so I guess he will see the new day. I take him out onto the patio, and he tells me that of all the money Clara has given away, almost none went to serious organizations. It went into creating new and better and more clever and sounder in terms of strategy and more fighting groups, each with a new approach, each with a different and more urgent purpose, and indeed many of them do have a more urgent purpose, which is the economic survival of their working committees. They are created not for the relief of blacks, but for the relief of whites. They are nothing more than group therapy for whites. The blacks in those mushrooming setups are actually self-appointed therapists who relieve the whites of their money while relieving their conscience. The Catholic Church used to be great at that. Pay for your sins, you'll feel better. The aim of some of these organizations is not to help the people, it's to exist. Black leadership should take a mighty look into all this. We go back into the house. I'm trying not to look at Clara. Anyhow, she isn't really there anymore. What remains of her is what amphetamines do to you when they clash head on with liquor. I knew another girl like her, a girl of extraordinary beauty, Lynn. She was a Texas girl, and you may have seen her in The Arrow and the Flame. One evening, she had gone to bed after taking those pills, and they found her lovely body, 3 days later, pancaked against the wall in her folding bed, which had closed. Clara sobs hysterically. She says to Jean, I'm telling you, honey, you either work for them or you screw with them. You can't do both. Shut up, for Christ's sake, says Mark. Let her talk, Jean begs. She'll feel better. Because if you begin to mix the two, everyone thinks you're pathological. No one believes you're with blacks because of your ideas, but only because of your hot ass. Give me another drink. No, you won't. There's a meeting tonight. Because, hun, when your ass gets mixed up in it, everything gets screwy, distorted, sick. The worst thing you can do for civil rights is to fuck with them. That's what all the real mean racists, black and white, want you to do that makes you fit the white trash label. You're playing into their hands. That way, they can say that all that stuff about justice and equality, it's just an excuse to get your kicks. And there's another thing, hun. A black bastard isn't black anymore. He's just a bastard. Amen, says Mark. Do you really want to make that meeting? Of course I do. Marlon Brando's going to be there. Barbara Streisand's going to be there. Jack Lemmon. All the big time Hollywood will be there. I can't possibly not go. I can't do that to them. The committee, I mean. They need my name for prestige. Come on, let's go. And so we went. Chapter 17. It was in the home of a producer in Bel Air, and Coretta King and the Reverend Ralph Abernathy were guests of honor at the meeting. And indeed, all big-time Hollywood was there, and Marlon Brando and all the others. I came out of it badly shaken. The purpose was to raise funds for the Poor People's March on Washington. The organizers planned to put 100,000 people on the road to the federal capital by bus, horse, or any means that came to hand. The people were destitute blacks, Mexicans, Indians, Puerto Ricans, and they were to build a poor people's village a mile from the White House. The whole idea had been conceived by Abernathy and bore a touching biblical mark with its echo of the Virgin Mary on her donkey and the star of the Good Shepherd. In terms of actual strategy, it also bore the mark of a completely out-of-touch provincialism and looked like something more concerned with the Bible than with the poor. For if there are still wise men around in our time, all they seem to bring in the way of gifts is napalm, tyranny, and bloodshed. And the very expression, poor people, was the kind of terminology that immediately puts the whole thing out of the field of ideological struggle and dignity and merely smacks of the wet kiss of charity. And now imagine a gorgeous residence in Bel Air, everything that Hollywood can bring together in terms of talent, beauty, and wealth, a buffet groaning under an almost Russian weight of zakuski, caviar, and champagne, flashlights, mics, and all the stars, some of them so famous and so mythological that before actually identifying them, you wonder at the resemblance. Now, hear me out. You can be rich, famous, beautiful, and a liberal, and you won't catch me yapping at that. As for the liberals' perennial inability to materialize their beliefs, well, liberalism is a light. It has never been a road, and if it shows you a direction, it won't tell you how to get there. So let all those who keep harping at me for laughing at liberals remember that a man's sacred right is to laugh at himself. It only proves that he can take it. It also proves he is sure of himself. Now the gentle-looking Dr. Abernathy gets up and, with a few words and the skill of a conjurer, brings before my eyes a little wooden church, the cotton fields, slaves all dressed in white rushing to hear the preacher. Frankly, lovely as it is, I do not believe it fits the times or the spirit of the young men around him, Reverend Jesse Jackson, or Andrew Young, and so many others. Only Jackson, a black who is among us as if he had come back from the future for a look at the present, dares to let the cat out of the bag. Generosity, yes, sure, but we can't solve the problem of 20 million black Americans without a change in American society as a whole. Good Dr. Abernathy proceeds to describe at great length the last moments he spent in the motel room he shared with Martin Luther King at the time of his murder, a pathetically sincere attempt, intolerable in its naivete, a burning and yet ineffectual desire to confer on those last moments an aura of biblical light and immortality, transforming the murderous savagery of the deed into a second-rate crucifixion devoid of the narrative genius of the apostles. Please, Dr. Abernathy, please. There you are telling us about the shaving cream Martin Luther King was holding in his hand a few minutes before he was killed. There you are telling us how he passed that tube to you because you had forgotten your own, and how he said if you wished to help yourself to it, you were welcome. Yes, of course, I know. I understand. His tube of shaving cream will become a relic. It will acquire an odor of sanctity. It may start something wonderful, something full of peace and love. Yes, how well I know. But you forget there's no more room left in the Bible. It's booked up. It has been turning people away for a long time. Take it from me, Dr. Abernathy, though you may consider me a cynic. God won't show up at his black rendezvous. He's already missed quite a few others. Quite frankly, I expect more from men like the Reverend Mr. Jackson than from the Almighty, no blasphemy intended. It is just that the two of them are not walking the same beat. I won't be too harsh on my neighbor, and I shall not give his name for the sake of his grandchildren. Taking advantage of a change of speakers, he whispers in my ear, "There's at least $30 million worth of entertainment in this room. Can you imagine?" True enough. They are all there, from Belafonte to Barbara Streisand and 200 others, and they are all listening to Dr. Abernathy tell them about the March of the Poor People and about the shaving cream that has just acquired an odor of saintliness. In the first row, Marlon Brando, sitting with his Tahitian wife, a jacket of rawhide leather, a lion's mane, a rolled-up collar underlying the chin. He was one of the first actors to come up with generous, all-out help for the civil rights cause. I am putting the word in quotes out of respect for invalids, the way you help them with their crutches. It has been overworked so much it's in bad need of help. He steps up to the mic. A silence, you know, one of those Brando silences, and then he looks sternly at the audience. Those who aren't here tonight, they better have a good excuse. I go, Jawal. Get a stab from Gene's elbow, or was it Natalie Woods, and shut up. But the threat made everyone feel uncomfortable. Besides, he was hamming it up. The place was full of professionals. Damn it, he ought to be able to do better than that. But the worst was yet to come. after a few words about the millions of children throughout the world who fall victim to mental degeneration brought on by undernourishment, Brando has helped UNICEF generously and tirelessly. He stresses the importance of the present meeting and the necessity to keep up the work started here tonight. For that purpose, he calls for the formation of a steering committee and asks for volunteers. Out of some 300 personalities present, 30 raise their hands. Obviously, more than enough. If there were 300 people in a steering committee, all it would mean is that there would still be a steering committee to be made up. And here, in one sentence, Marlon Brando suddenly reveals more about himself and about the deeper nature of the relationship between certain white friends of militants with themselves. I do mean with themselves and not with the blacks, than a long psychiatric study. He glares at the audience and at the 30 raised hands. He braces himself, balances his shoulders in that famous half roll, then the chin goes up. He is acting. Or rather, overacting, for the sudden violence in his voice and the tightening of his facial muscles and of the jaws bears no relation whatsoever to the situation, however he may truly feel about it. The reaction is not in any way spontaneous, but calculated, premeditated, and entirely self-centered, in the sense that the man is concentrating on projecting his own image, or rather an image of himself he graciously favors, and if there is any sincerity at all in his voice, it is that of the eternal spoiled brat. Those who didn't raise their hands, get the hell out of here. Whenever a man behaves like a jerk, I feel as if I have lost face myself. I am fully aware that Marlon Brando was acting out the to the wall situation of the Black Panthers, but when you happen to be a millionaire who doesn't even run the risk of a kick in the ass, the effect is not that of a panther, black or white, but of a deluxe poodle pissing on the carpet. There was something truly sickening and sick in this bullying, this provocation, and that phony air of a down-to-the-last-bullet desperado, in this aping of quite another kind of hostility, an authentic one, which rises from the black blood on the pavement. The 300 actors, writers, directors, producers, had only moments before stated in writing what help they wished to offer in terms of money, work, or both, and they simply did not feel qualified to sit on a steering committee in charge of the funds. Get the hell out of here. Let us forget Marlon Brando and his White Panther act that didn't come off. What is important to say is that there are misfits among white liberals and militants who use Black America's tragedy and its authentic feeling of injustice for pathological reasons of their own, a transfer of their personal grudges and feelings of inferiority or unfulfillment out of the psychological field into the social, so that their paranoid tendencies appear on the surface as a perfectly valid feeling of social resentment. In this way, those who harbor within them a slightly paranoid sense of persecution use the resentment of truly pathological grudge against the world. There are personalities who have reached what is known as the summit of success, and yet frequently harbor a deep sense of frustration and rejection because their ego is constantly racing after their superego, a race the ego is condemned to lose. And people who feel alienated, because of this egomania, tend to identify themselves with a human community that is really in a state of both alienation and social inferiority, so that the king of I finds at last in them a kingdom over which he can reign. The black radicals know all this only too well and often refer to it jokingly. They are perfectly aware that the help offered to them by certain whites is motivated by personal neurotic reasons, and that it often amounts to using the American racial tragedy for motives that have precious little to do with the black situation per se. One black leader once said to me, grinning, as he watched a famous Hollywood personality stroll away, "We've helped him a lot." Before the meeting was over, we were offered a few fine comic interludes. The young producer who came up to Jean wagging his tail and tried to talk to her didn't look at all like a frank, open, typical bastard. No. He had a clean-cut, crew-cut, all-American, Ivy League, Brooks Brothers, my son, the officer and gentleman, appearance. A few weeks earlier, he had given Jean a $100 check out of the sincerity of his heart and of his much-trumpeted liberalism and progressive outlook for the Montessori School Without Hate, which was Seberg's contribution to childhood. Then, after all, you've got to get something for your money. He asked Jean to dinner at Connie's. I said yes, Jean said yes, and it all looked nice and friendly until Jean came down with a head-splitting migraine, no doubt induced by this act against nature, and after vainly trying to reach the gentleman on the phone, canceled the outing by telegram. He called back, insisted, persisted, and for the next few days became a nuisance and a neurotic bore. Then, one day, my adorable wife, we had been 10 years together and I still adore her, mostly for her pioneering disbelief in people's ugliness, came home, sat down, and stared at me. Would you believe it? That little creep has instructed his bank to cancel his $100 check. May we. We have a word in French for guys like that. We call them les masturbés. I shall never know what it was he still wanted from Jean, but as he tried to speak, Seberg almost turned yellow with dislike and, cross my heart, emitted a long, loud, viperine hiss the like of which I've never heard before and hope I shall never hear again. Then there was the magnificent cry from the heart of a young director, husband of a famous blonde actress, who rose and addressed the audience in these terms. It's simply not enough to give money. We must go into the black families, have dinner with them once a week, get to know them. Friends, the year was 1968. Yes, the egg of Christopher Columbus, monstrous in its enormity, suddenly emerged in its triumphant evidence in the midst of the richest and most powerful society in history. We must go into the black families and get to know them. Yes, I repeat, in 1968, and it wasn't Daddy's America which was thus suddenly waking up. The fellow was 37 years old. There are over 20 million black Americans, and they have been around for some time. There is Watts, a 20-minute drive. Christopher Columbus's egg grew bigger right there in front of me, like in an Ionesco play. Eureka! The discovery of America by Americans. Ah, Putain. around the platform, Belafonte, the Reverend Mr. Young, the Reverend Mr. Jackson were desperately trying to keep straight faces. We must invite them to dinner. Go in to the black families. Get to know them. I had the impression that Young was shaking like a leaf and was going to burst out laughing along with Columbus's egg, that white egg full of black laughter, the blackest, richest laughter in the world. As I mentioned, the contributions each of the personalities present wished to make had been spelled out discreetly on slips of paper and enclosed in envelopes so as to avoid any possible embarrassing comparisons between the figures. But someone had forgotten we were in the capital of show business. This kind of anonymity went against the grain. I shall not tell the name of the simpatico star who was first to rebel against these veils of tactful discretion, but after licking his envelope and closing it, this popular comedian and one of the nicest guys in the profession jumped to his feet and roared, "I donate every goddamn bit of the salary from my next picture." The floodgates had opened. From one end of the room to the other, in an instant pitch of excitement and enthusiasm, they all began jumping up, yelling figures, outbidding each other with the frenzied delight of Wall Street on a good day, bursting into applause at some particularly high and impressive offer, with the totals of the fundraising and hitting the ceiling and the Dow Jones average losing its head. Emotion overswept the place, and there were tears in the eyes, and even the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who had quietly dozed off on the dais during the speeches, woke up beaming, while Young and Jackson and Belafonte stood there with that look of total blankness which comes from trying politely to keep your face straight. And towering over all this, the haunting, unforgettable dignity and beauty of Coretta King. You don't often get a chance to repeat yourself with gratitude because certainties don't come your way often. I shall therefore repeat that in all my life I have never seen a more beautiful and noble woman's face. Chapter 18. I don't want to harp about liberalism. I shall only say that whatever obvious ridicule, ineffectual stammering, stuttering lip service without actually doing anything about it, and, generally speaking, natural inclination toward velleity you may find in it, liberalism has always been my only guiding light. It is as absurd to turn toward it in search of practical program, strategy, actual doing, and solving, as it is absurd to ask the Christian dogma to come up with a technical plan for a 5-year economic and social great leap forward. Its main role in these beastly times is to point out clearly where beastliness lies, which task liberalism does accomplish, and in the present darkness, this is no small achievement. It helps you immediately to situate yourself, to choose your allies and recognize your enemies. It reminds you constantly of what civilization should be about. It is an inner drive, not a road map. Soul has no hands. But it can also be dressing up, a showing off of surface elegance. A sham is a sham is a sham, and a phony, lip service type of liberalism, while doing no great harm, is particularly infuriating because it turns a spiritual light into a sort of Elizabeth Arden beauty salon with the unique purpose of beautifying your little kingdom of I. We are driving back from the fundraising meeting in the company of the agent Lloyd Katzenellenbogen, his brother St. Robert, and Agent Seymour Blitz, all three in the throes of mea culpa. They're beating their breasts, and I feel like offering them the ashes from my cigar so that they can throw them over their guilty heads. The merit badge of intellectual elite status in America is guilt. A display of social guilt is a must for the moral upper class establishment, and with the so-called common people, you will never come across it. They have a natural reluctance towards exhibitionism. To show your bad conscience is proof that you have a good conscience in perfect working condition and, indeed, a conscience at all. It shows your high credentials. I hardly need mention I am not dealing with sincerity here. I'm talking about affection and window dressing. A civilization worthy of that name will always feel guilty toward man. It is by that sign that you recognize a civilization. My three passengers are working hard on their autocritique. Lloyd Katzenellenbogen is the one who reaches the greatest heights of tolerance, self-denigration, and understanding. He is the agent for some of the best fiction writers and playwrights of today. We are getting exactly what we deserve, harvesting what we have sown. When a Leroy Jones calls for cutting our throats, or black Muslims say among themselves that all whites should be castrated, sure, it's hard to take, but this is nothing but a reflection of the crimes we have been committing for centuries, from the very beginning of the slave trade. Behind every black who burns or rapes is our crime. We are the ones who chained them together like animals on our slave ships in filth and sickness so that 50% of the cargo died on their way. Seymour Blitz breaks in. We have no more right to forget what our ancestors did to the Negro than the Germans have to forget Hitler. We have committed a crime against humanity which makes the so-called violence of the blacks today look like baby's play. We... I double up with laughter. I can't control it. This is one of the funniest things that has ever thrown me into convulsions, and I have been through some convulsions in my life. What the hell is the matter with you? Seymour Blitz barks, biting his cigar furiously. I'll tell you what. I wipe the tears of mirth. Yeah, I'll tell you. All three of you are Jews from Eastern Europe. Even if you yourselves were born here, your fathers and grandfathers were still rotting in the ghetto between two pogroms and denied every human right while slavery no longer existed here. But when you blame your own Jewish ass for slavery, when you say, we, the slave drivers, you get a hell of a big bang out of it because it makes you feel 100% American. You assume the American guilt because it shows how integrated and assimilated you are, even if your slave-driving ancestors were actually being killed off at the rate of 1,000 or 2 in a good year, depending on the mood of the Cossacks, Ottomans, or of the Tsar's ministers. You'd rather to think of them as white slave-trading gentlemen than as Jewish niggers. Makes you feel you truly belong. I'm not saying you don't give a shit about the blacks. Why, thanks, yells St. Robert, who is Jewish, as his name indicates so clearly. But it helps you to get rid of that I am an insecure minority feeling. If your granddad was a slave driver, that makes you, if not quite Mayflower and Wasp, well, the next best thing to it. You make me sick. In 1963, I was at my lawyer's home in New York when the news of John the 23rd's death came on TV. There were only Jews there, and you never heard such sobs crying their hearts out. You'd have thought they just lost their Lord and Savior Jesus. He's high, St. Robert declares firmly, and this is true enough, though I never touch liquor or grass or LSD because I have a nice mafioso complicity with myself, and I can't bear to be deprived of such pleasant company through drink or dope. But I do get high. All it takes is indignation. That's how you become a writer. The atmosphere is decidedly chilly, so we agree to have dinner at the bistro to salvage a few bits of our friendship. Our conversation at this Hollywood summit is kept at the highest level and never falls below $400,000 against 10% of gross. Then St. Robert, forgetting that feast of understanding on our way here, begins to fulminate against the recent anti-Semitic demonstrations in Harlem. Since the pseudo-Islamized black fringe began to attack Jews as Jews and not merely as whites, some of the Jews began to react racially. It's the famous backlash. The stupidity of it all is enough to make you cry, as my mother, who never cried, used to say. On my last trip out here, I had run into my first anti-Semitic Negro at none other than Lloyd Katzenellenbogen's home. He was a writer of some sort, Lloyd's client. It was beautiful. Lloyd was so full of understanding, it was beginning to look as if he didn't give a damn. He kept offering that other cheek with a patience that was the closest thing to total ruthless disregard for human cheeks I have ever come across. The dialogue, I am quoting from memory, and it's a bit unreliable, as I had to leave the table twice to get myself back on my leash again, went more or less like this. The militant. You Jews, you own the ghetto. Buildings, homes, stores. Me. Goddamn lie. 50%'s owned by blacks. The rest is multinational. The militant. You are the pawn shop owners and the moneylenders. You sell us your goods 20% higher than they cost in white neighborhoods. One of these days, we're going to cut your ears off. Katzenellenbogen. Have a little more chicken. The militant, helping himself. Thank you. You bastards are bleeding us white. Me, in French. If your black shit eater keeps asking for more, I'll oblige. Katzenellenbogen, in French. You can't understand. You've got to be an American to understand. We have been castrating them for centuries. They have to assert themselves. Shut up. The militant. Of course, there's nothing personal in what I'm saying here. I know where to draw the line. I'm perfectly aware that you're different, Lloyd. Me. That's right, Lloyd. Some of his best friends are Jews. The militant. It's salad time now. Look at the soul stations. Almost all of them belong to Jews. Me. Meaning, without the kikes, there would be no soul stations in America? The militant. I mean, Jews are making all the profit. Me. Do I get it correctly? You are anti-Semitic, aren't you? The militant. You're not American. You can't understand. Me. Because, after all, your Republic of New Africa is eyewash and you yourself feel 100% American? Katzenellenbogen. Romaine, that's racist talk. Have some cheese. me. Drop dead. Anyway, I find the idea of a black anti-Semite attractive. It goes to prove that blacks need Jews the same as everybody else. This anti-Semitism is partly due to the mask of Arabism and Islam some blacks are trying on in search of a spiritual elsewhere. 99% of them ignore the historical fact that Arab conquerors massacred their ancestors, were the first to reduce them to slavery, and sold them like cattle on the hoof, turning them into eunuchs, servants, converting them to Islam by the sword of the same name, and destroying the original African religion, which was animist. It would be inexcusable and downright ignoble to blame the present-day Arabs for these crimes, which were not regarded as crimes at all in that historical period. There is nothing more absurd than hindsight moral judgments passed by the present on the past. But to make the leap from that to seeing in Islam the spiritual home of African soul and its cultural identity takes a few light years travel, and when Malcolm X wrote about his feeling toward whites, how could I love the man who has raped my mother, killed my father, and reduced my ancestors to slavery? That was exactly what he was doing when he took up his journey to Mecca. What about that dog of yours? Seymour Blitz asks. What about it? Still with the SS? I concentrate on my food. While the agent tells the story to the others in a compassionate voice, as if he were talking about a member of my family who had been assistant to Eichmann. Katzenellenbogen says nothing, but he seems interested. He was. He phoned me the next day. May I see you? For quite a while now, he's been trying to become Gene's agent. Come along. What have I got to lose? He is there 20 minutes later, accepts a Bloody Mary, sits there quietly. He's an immaculate dresser. It all comes from Carol's, but with that strong personal something that makes you want to buy it from him. Shining buttons, cufflinks, watch, and what with that light ginger hair, freckles, and amber skin, he looks pure gold. I want to talk to you about that dog, he says. I thought it over last night, and I've spoken to my wife. I think we might be able to help you. How's that? Well, obviously, the dog can't be kept in a cage the rest of his life, and you can't look after him either with all your travels. I begin to smell a rat. I can almost feel my hair bristling. I stare at him. I think we could give your dog a good home. Our house, as you know, is in a fairly isolated spot, and the dog could run around freely. He looks so sincere and natural, and he represents so many good writers that without that radar I have right in the small of my back, which begins to send warning signals up my spine at the approach of an underwater swimmer. Blacks are supposed to be responsible for most of the crime in big cities, and since Watts, lots of people in L.A. have been taking precautions. With a dog like Batka, any black coming near a home would hear a howl that would touch him right in his atavistic something. And it explains, aside from the economic reasons, why there are mighty few dogs in black families. Now, the gentleman before me is one of the most outspoken liberals. Pacifist, marcher, protester, shoulder to shoulder with the blacks, you name it. He's got it. I keep my cool. What the hell? This is show business. Tatsy is one of those progressives who are all show and no business. Sorry, friend. You came too late. I've already promised the dog to Mayor Yorty. Captain Ellenbogen looks as if he'd just been stung by a wasp. I get up. But if White Dog has some white puppies, I'll think of you. He makes for the door with that furious, resolute walk which often takes the place of violence, verbal or otherwise, with people of quiet or cowardly disposition. I had very little sleep that night. I was thinking, in my darkness, that Don Quixote was an implacable realist who knew that the familiar banality of those windmills was an illusion and that they were there only to hide from view the monstrous and threatening dragon. And Sancho Panza was a romantic, an inveterate dreamer, incapable of facing reality like one of those blind believers who went on thinking for over 30 years that Stalin was a loving father of the people, and that the fake trials, the purges, and the 20 million dead were just capitalist propaganda. Don Quixote knew, with exemplary lucidity, that admirable realist clearly perceived the demons and genetic hydra who raise their filthy heads at the slightest opportunity from our inner snake pit. I turn on my lamp and pick up Cleaver's autobiography. I hit immediately upon a quotation from Leroy Jones. Come up, black dada, nihilismus, rape the white girls, rape their fathers, cut the mother's throat. Shit. I get out of bed. My thoughts wander aimlessly as I wander myself at the wheel of my olds in this vague, hesitating city. I drive out to Malibu to listen to the ocean. Only the ocean has the vocal means needed to speak in the name of man. But my brother the ocean is sleeping. I drive to the ranch and go in to Pete the Strangler's cage. He unrolls himself obligingly, then slips into his prudent triangle position. We stare at one another. When that python goggles at a man with his round, beady eyes, he looks as if he had never seen anything like that or had even thought it possible. We watch each other for a while, once again fraternizing in our total lack of comprehension, in our bewilderment. We are exchanging our impressions, so to speak, and they can be summed up in one word: monstrous. I visit Batka and get the same warm welcome that always delights the 8-year-old kid I shelter within me. He puts his head on my knees and dozes off while I gorge myself on Russian pickled cucumbers and black bread bought at Hughes Market. Then I doze off myself and wake up with Batka's adoring eyes watching me. The one place in this world where you are always sure to meet a man worthy of that name is in a dog's eyes. Keys finds us like that, basking in brotherhood. Hi. Hi. He feeds the dog. Batka whores around, jumps, licks the black hands, and wriggles his behind. Keys glances at me sideways, grinning. Wow, I say, in the way of a compliment. Yep, he's coming along fine. Just fine. He straightens up and lights a cigarette, then watches me with an odd, almost mocking look in his eye. The bastard. I shall never forgive him.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast. End of our first segment. Romaine Gary, White Dog. If you have comments, thoughts to share, the number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Picking up on chapter 19, once we get done with our dialogue. Number to dial again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. You can drop an email as well if you have thoughts you would like to share. Once again, hear the bashing of Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, continuing. Even this week, that's 3 weeks in a row. Stunning. Anywho, I'll go to get folks who dialed in. Certainly any thoughts, observations, questions that you have about the text, feel free to share. My question, I guess, would be what do we make of his commentary? He's writing all of this literally the day and subsequent hours, days after the assassination of Dr. King. What do we make of such simultaneous commentary? I mean, this is not him reflecting on what happened April 4, 1968, like a few years later, him thinking about it. I read a few books on it and researched it and him writing about it at night. This is live time as it happened. We don't even, James Earl Ray name isn't even known. Like, oh my gosh, Dr. King has been killed. And you know these folks, you've been hanging out and all of that. What do we make of what he has to say about the passing of Dr. King, since he's been talking about that for a couple of weeks now? Folks have thoughts on that. Any other questions, feel free. We'll see. let's see which folks have questions, comments to share. Get to some of the folks who wrote in observations as well. Let's see. First call the folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Hello, all. I hope everyone is doing their best for Thursday in whatever way you can. I have a couple of things that caught my attention. Of course, we'll start with chapter 16. When I think Keyes was being spoken to by the author, saying that Keyes is different from other Negroes. When I hear lines like that, personally, it makes me think about the idea that, white people make you feel like, maybe you're a professional black person, maybe you moved out of the so-called ghetto or something like that, and that idea that by simply saying that you're different than other Negroes is that idea of, separating you from the group. And, of course, to a certain degree, when it's time to pick you off, now you're all by yourself because, white people make you feel like you're no longer a nigger until you're a nigger. Let's see. Clara is known among black extremists as a big lover. That whole chapter with Clara was just simply nothing but cowbells. It's almost as if they were making her seem as if she was doing some kind of good by sleeping with black men, like she was making the world a better place. Black women find it to be the worst when white women jump from black man to black man, which basically was Clara. Whatever the relationship with black women in the context of black men, basically this is basically Clara, the white woman, playing that divide and conquer, creating friction between black couple relationships. Let's see. There was a part about churches and how people basically go there to assuage their guilt, and of course churches use it as nothing more than a way to make money off of people's guilt, which in my personal opinion hasn't changed much in Lord knows how many decades, if not years, to a certain degree. You know, I think back when you have people on like Jeremiah Kamara trying to explain this. Let's see, there was a part that talked about the idea of tattoo face place, etc., as signs of savagery for like African people, as like where basically make it seem like, you know, black people are uncivilized because they still do things like tattoos, face plates, and things of that nature. I find that completely ironic, too, because obviously we now live in the 21st century in America where we clearly see a whole bunch of white people doing those very same things where they get face tattoos or tattoos all over their bodies and stuff of that nature as well, too. But I don't think I've ever heard one time white people be referred to as being savage or uncivilized when they do things like that. Let's see, a white woman proposing that interracial sex may be a solution to racism. That was on page 161. And I think that was a reference to Clara as well, too. And as we know, you know, I don't think there's ever been a time where rape, you know, though we call it sex from time to time, has not occurred between white and black people. So as a potential solution, obviously makes no sense. Clara gives money to serious organizations which may not be effective. I think they were talking about, for example, giving money to organizations to combat racism and things of that nature. And to me, that's no different than what we have right now. You know, people who, you know, like when you hear stories of people like, you know, George Soros, suspected racist, giving money to black organizations. And if people are unfamiliar with this, usually when people, especially rich people, give money to nonprofit organizations, basically this is a tax write-off. It lowers their taxable income. And this is problematic on many levels because one thing, they get to use that to sculpt what is, you know, a social justice issue with large amounts of money. And then also the government is deprived of potential tax revenue to actually engage in actually social purposes like, you know, welfare or any of those kind of natures, because basically the people who basically have a lot of money are not paying their taxes because they're using it as a tax write-off to basically, you know, social conditioning or social engineering of the greater society. When they were in the room, it said that there's $35 million worth of celebrities in the room. Unfortunately, I don't think there's any other group of black people who it seems that when it's time to deal with any kind of problems in the black society, that celebrities are used to deal with black issues, as opposed to when white people have problems, when any other groups have problems, they go to their professionals who study the issue, not just celebrities who might have a platform or have name recognition. Let's see, if we skip to chapter, I think 17. White liberals, white liberal militants who use black tragedy to push for the Negro, their own personal grudges and feelings. Well, let's see. It's, you know, obviously we're in an election season right now, and basically everyone's trying to make it seem like everything that goes wrong in society, you know, they say, oh my God, this black person got harmed, and then basically it just gets pivoted to some kind of other issue, whether it's LGBTQ, women's rights, immigrants and stuff like that. Basically, it starts with some black, like Tommy Curry always said, it starts with some black person being harmed or killed, and then before we know it, we're off on a tangent talking about something that's other than the black man being killed in the white supremacist system that gave rise to his death. And let's see. This particular statement right here on page 172, they are perfectly aware that the help offered to them by certain whites is motivated by personal neurotic reasons, and that it often amounts to using the American racial tragedy for motives that have precious little to do with black situations. I think that basically is just an addendum to what was said about the idea of white liberal militants. And then the last thing I wrote, or the last note that I took, was the idea of eating with every black family in the country to help, you know, with the racial divide, whatever that means. And that becomes very interesting because, you know, to a certain degree, I mean, especially since, you know, what is it called? When black people were still living on a plantation, and to a certain degree, you know, black people were the servants of white people. So they were definitely in a room when eating was happening to a certain degree. And I remember once upon a time, last time, you know, during like, for example, you know, during the civil rights era, black people tried to integrate lunch counters and stuff like that. And white people last time I checked, reacted with violence. And though we now live in an era where black people are able, for the most part, to go into a restaurant and get something to eat, we hear of all these different stories of some kind of violent altercation breaking out, someone getting into a fight, someone having, well, hopefully a black person having to defend themselves, some white person walking by and calling a black person nigger, showing that really much has not changed. And I will mute my line there.
Much obliged, non-Clemson grad, maybe Misty as well, other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Very similar to today. Funds go out. Doesn't seem to go. Did Mr. Fuller get a check? People can check in. Did Dr. Cambon, Marimba Ani, some of the folks that we think are doing great work, Dr. Curry, Dr. Hassan, did any of these folks get a check in the mail? Sabrina Johnson, I forgot to check in with her. Keep the Welsing Institute going. Any of these folks get a big fat donation to keep things going in the name of Breonna Taylor? You know, what? Never mind. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Can I be heard? Mo in Dallas, yes, sir.
Thank you. Good evening, callers. I'm sorry, I was rushing out of work, so I can speak. I'm sitting in my car now. My notes are kind of scrambled because I was working while I was listening. So, but again, thank you for the program, and thank you, Gus, for the book. It's still a great book. I'm sorry I missed last week. First I have, when Keys actually asked to for the dog, just a flat out yes or no, Gary like expressed fear, and the quote I wrote was, "I cannot bear finality." His response was, "We'll talk later." He was certain that he didn't want to give Keys a dog, you know. And in my opinion, that was a practice of, you know, right then and right there, he was practicing racism, because he knew he had no interest in giving the dog to Keys, but he knew that, you know, it was like a time wasting mechanism. You know, he's gonna let him Keys keep the dog and keep working with him, and maybe, you know, take him later. Clara and her money going to writing, going to committees. You know, that were supposed to be helping. You know, the cause or whatever you said, I feel like she was aware that money wasn't being, you know, that she was using that money to like support other people that were supporting the cause, instead of just supporting the cause and applying the money to where it could be used directly. My theory for that is because in chapter 16 it says liberals can't materialize their beliefs. I think that I wrote that quote down because I feel like that's what she was doing. She understood her position as a liberal was to, like, feed the machine, you know, so her money was a sacrifice for that, and I think she was sacrificing her funds in order to have the "I'm down with the cause at the time" kind of mentality. I also wrote down black bastards aren't black anymore. They're just bastards. And I thought that was very interesting, because later on in the reading, like, he kept referring to black males as bastards, like just straight bastards. I thought that was very interesting. When the Jewish people were talking about how, you know, we were responsible for these atrocities, and I believe it was the author who challenged them on that, you know, and was saying, you know, while you were, they're making these comments so they can have some ideal of, you know, camaraderie with whiteness. I would just like for it to be known that Jews did own slaves during chattel slavery. Jews did insure boats, and they did insure bodies. So, I mean, that was just wrong, but he is a liar. And consuming Russian pickled cucumbers and black bread, that just reminded me of the Delectable Negro. I thought that was very interesting. And I also, on a personal note, I was walking my black dog. I thought this was very interesting. I was walking my black dog, and a white female actually did a U-turn, pulled into a gas station, and yelled something at me. And I didn't hear her because I was talking to my nephew. And I said, "Excuse me, I didn't help you." And she was like, "You need to put some socks on your dog." And I was like, "Ma'am, you know, yeah, you need to put some socks on your dog." And I froze because I didn't know how to respond to that. So I stayed in the question lane, and I was like, "Well, okay, is there anything that I can help you with?" And she just seemed, she got really red in the face and angry and just drove away, like, really aggressive. I thought that was very interesting, especially since I'm reading this book. I thought that was comical. Well, that's all I have. Thank you, and I mute my line.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. White women do it better. I'm not a pet person, like, period. I've never been, like, a cat person, hamsters, fish, parakeets, snakes, none of that, dogs either. But I'm aware that for some dog owners in the summertime, they've had the heat wave and everything. So, you know, they, you know, care, we'll step over, you know, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, step over them every day. But, oh, my Lord, do you mean little Vodka's paws might burn on the pavement? Oh, my, we've got to get him some little booties. And, I mean, they got gelato out here in Seattle. They've had that for a long time. So, you know, I understand black lives do not matter. I'm a Negro, potential rapist. I got it. But, wow, she might have called the authorities, like, hearing that sort of thing. Like, well, white people do not play with dogs. I've heard from a number of non-white dog owners where you can get in a lot of trouble with that dog. They see you messing around, looks like you might have left him in the car or didn't feed him enough times or what. Like, they take it Romulus and Remus, the ISIS papers. They do not mess around. Anywho, other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I was going to make an attempt to diagnose. I think you asked a question about basically what it was saying, that I think that you were saying, is that the downplaying of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's death during that time. He kind of like skated through that quote unquote central figure to talk about other things. Is that somewhat what you were referring to?
Well, just what do people think, you know, just keeping that in my context, you know, the time period that this is happening.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of times, 1968, what do people think, you know, is
right
about what he has to say about Dr. King, the assassination, things that are happening around that? What do we think about this white man's coverage of these events as they happen?
Okay. Because basically the way I explained it is what I kind of like noticed from listening to the readings. In and around between, I would say, 1955, when Dr. King became at least a regional factor as far as known personality, and to the time of his death in 1968, is when, in this part of the world, under the system of racist white supremacy, the media basically would take a personality and form that personality into something, you know, to the readers or the viewers on television. Television by that time started becoming very profound, and I think it took over from newspaper and radio, and he became a personality. Ratings even started with personalities, and during the time in this reading of the book, I would say it was at Reverend King's lowest point in time. Not so much because of him personally or what he was doing. It's just a strategy of the races. And basically, during that time, already the Civil Rights Act, the Voters' Rights Act, which is a derivative of the white supremacists from what he was doing. In other words, okay, nigga, we don't solve the problem now, so you're irrelevant now. And then by that time, he had started speaking out on the Vietnam War, which to me gave me an idea and understanding that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King had a understanding of the global system of racism and white supremacy. When he started, all anyone has to do is just read that speech that he did in New York. They compartmentalized him in that way. And in turn, after 1964, and he won that big award, I forgot the name of it, Nobel Peace Prize. Those two, Voters' Rights Act and Civil Rights Act, then the more younger non-white black people started, voice and activity started up, you know, with Watts and the different riots in different parts of the U.S. that caused the white supremacists to start something called the Kerner Commission. And in turn, they started suppressing the attention on Dr. King and what he was doing at the time, even up to his death. Now, I'm not saying he was no longer spoke about, but I would say he was at his lowest as far as attention to what he was doing at the time. And in turn, activities and ideas and minds that were being initiated and talked about by more younger people, such as Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown, the Black Panther Party were getting started in and around 1966, 1967. That was more, and they were, it basically was white people speaking about what is the more threat to them at the particular point in time. And then all of a sudden he got assassinated. Of course, there's going to be some immediate attention to it. But it sounds like from me listening to the readings is that he's speaking more on what was more relevant into a danger for white people, including himself, during that time. Because even after when Dr. King got killed, that particular quote unquote poor people's campaign just meandered around for about a few weeks, a few months, and just dissipated to almost, you know, nothing at the time. So those are just my thoughts from me reading, listening to the reading, and at the same time, I mean, I was a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, it's not that I had a real good understanding of what was going on, other than I did know what was going on at the time. But, you know, over the course of time of reading, understanding, comparing to what I'm listening to now, it gives me the reason on why, you know, of the thoughts that I'm expressing now on why he was kind of like, you know, not necessarily talked about, which, you know, primarily someone would figure that he should be talked about at that point in time. But hopefully that made some sense. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Something to kind of pay attention to. You know, where's the focus at from this white man, Romaine Gary, as he is writing as Dr. King, live time, as Dr. King is murdered. One of the people, one of our investors, wrote in written commentary. Greetings, Gus. Christopher Columbus reportedly used dogs against the indigenous people of Hispaniola, Haiti, the Tainos, in 1492, a reference regarding this remembering Haiti and Tainos, May 20, 2018, by Antonio Coulon. The article shows an early painting depicting Columbus's dogs feasting on the Tainos. Chapter 15. Number 1. Keys. The most important thing in that kind of training with police dogs is smell. That's how the dog learns to recognize his own people. I found this statement metaphorical given the historical context of the noxious smell associated with black people by racist white supremacists. Number 2. The author. There exists a whole literature about the excitable emotionalism of blacks. The blacks. The ones I know rarely lose their cool. Some of them act as if they have been killed long ago. I thought this comment was revealing regarding the strategic advantage for non-white victims to keep their emotions under control, particularly when dealing with suspected racists. This has been frequently discussed on Cal's broadcasts. The author's interpretation that the lack of emotion represented death on the victim's part is the self-serving thoughts of a racist. Instead of being killed, I interpret the lack of emotion as calculating, thinking, which, of course, is antithetical to the racist white supremacist. Chapter 16. Number 1. Author. I sincerely believe that for some black militants, and particularly their wives, there is no human being more despised than a white woman who goes from one black lover to another. Given the power dynamic in the global system of racism, white supremacy, such feelings are expected. Moreover, being despised is one thing, but other than verbally demonstrating contempt, neither the black militants or their wives have any power over said white woman. Number 2. Author. Almost all of them were in African dress, in that affirmation of negritude that actually goes no further back in time than the cotton cloth manufactured in Manchester. I see no other future for this need for authenticity than rings in the nose, plates in the lips, and facial mutilations. This passage was revealing to me regarding the typical thoughts of a racist mocking the attempts by victims to attain a sense of connection to a history and land which was stolen from them. Number 3. Author. Clara finally took a black lover, then another. The fact that they were black was totally irrelevant. I don't think she even noticed at that point that they were. Living and working with people, you lose all awareness of the color of their skin. This reminds me of the favorite trope of suspected racists. I don't see color. Number 4, author. That was the beginning of gaming whitey. That's my favorite phrase from the book, gaming whitey. And it is now as dead as strategically as Carmichael. Another, again, ultimately gaming whitey, fooling racist white supremacists is not possible for victims in a global system of racism, white supremacy. Gaming whitey. Number 5, author. We know, and Clara knows that we know. Yes, they have just asked her to play the lead in Paint Your Wagon, a $15 million musical. Jean looks at me in consternation. She had accepted the part in the movie 2 weeks earlier. The contract was already signed. Clara will be so hurt. Clara being denied the part demonstrates the price of violating the white code. There are consequences. Number six, Clara, I'm telling you, honey, you either work for them or you screw with them. You can't do both. I think this is an accurate assessment of the global system of racism, white supremacy. Chapter 17, number one, the whole idea had been conceived by Abernathy and bore a touching biblical mark with its echo of the Virgin Mary on her donkey and the star of the Good Shepherd. In terms of actual strategy, it also bore the mark of a completely out-of-touch provincialism and looked like something more concerned with the Bible than with the poor. The author's comments regarding the poor people's village are contemptible. The remaining leaders of the so-called civil rights movement were reeling from the loss of a charismatic leader. Now, see, even in the comments, there's some grasp like, wow, we just, Dr. King just died. I don't know if that's really conveyed, but I mean, Dr. King just died, and I feel like the point of emphasis we got, you know, a Negro could have killed him. He said it more than what, you know, a Negro could have killed him. That no-count Stokely Carmichael thought he was a coon. Sellout. Uncle Tom. A Negro could have killed him. Anyway, reeling from the loss of MLK, in particular, Ralph Abernathy was thought of as the heir apparent in terms of leadership, in large part due to his high visibility nationally and close association with MLK prior to the assassination. His efforts to continue the legacy of MLK, albeit imperfect, I think were genuine. To mock these efforts for me is highly offensive and represents the expected musings of a racist. Number two, the black radicals know all this only too well and only refer to it jokingly. They are perfectly aware that the help offered to them is motivated by personal neurotic reasons, and it often amounts to using the American black racial tragedy for motives that have precious little to do with the black situation per se. In part because of the CALS program, I have become increasingly suspicious of all white allies and their motives. Along with these neurotic liberals, I include whites today who go on these mission trips to the third world, adopt babies from Africa, Madonna, and the like. Number three, friends, the year was 1968. Yes, the egg of Christopher Columbus, monstrous in its enormity, suddenly emerged in its triumphant evidence in the midst of the richest and most powerful society in history. I am not sure what the author meant by this metaphor, interested to hear what others think of it. This is when they're at the meeting and the fella gets up and says that this is one of the Hollywood whites and says, we need to go to black people's houses. You know, we need to have dinner with the Negro and meet with them once a week or so. This is when he's using that metaphor. If other folks have thoughts, feel free. Chapter 18, number one. This anti-Semitism is partly due to mask the Abrahamism and Islam some blacks are trying on in search of a spiritual elsewhere. 99% of them ignore the historical fact that Arab conquerors massacred their ancestors, were the first to reduce them to slavery, and sold them like cattle on the hoof, turning them into eunuchs, servants, converting them to Islam by the sword of the same name, and destroying the original African religion, which was animist. Skillfully, the author in this chapter reinforces the victim status of so-called Jews, denigrates the Nation of Islam, and characterizes traditional African religion as that of heathens. It has been my understanding that African religions were monotheistic, believing in a creator prior to subjugation by white people. Moreover, the characterization that they were originally animist, a term created by a racist man, is used to denigrate them as heathens and justify religious subjugation by whites in order to enlighten and save the savages. Religion of white supremacy. Number two, the author. Keys, he feeds the dog, he straightens up and lights a cigarette, then watches me with an odd, almost mocking look in his eye. The bastard. I shall never forgive him. The author's visceral contempt for Keys may be related to the fact that this black has gained a power advantage over him in terms of the white dog, which is totally unacceptable for a racist man. I think that could be the case as well. I definitely felt right at the beginning, the very first This is he. The person who wrote in has notes on chapter 19, but we haven't got that far. But I felt the same thing right at the beginning of this week's section. It's Vodka, Keys, Black Male, and the author, Romaine Gary. And so he's talking about the dog is rubbing Keys and going back and forth. And even though he says, you know, he's all proud that the dog is not chomping on black people and all the rest, but he's the way he starts chapter 15, he says, every time now I pay a visit to Vodka, I am made to feel an intruder, an outsider, and a pain in the neck, the sort of man who sits next to a couple of lovers in a park. That's where it started. I mean, it goes throughout, but in my view at least, him feeling like, what the heck? This was my white dog. Now he's over here loving on the Negra. I thought we were cool. He was with my family, and this Negra's got control over him. Even the metaphor that he uses, saying that he felt like a third wheel, as though he was this guy that comes to sit next to two lovers in the park. Now, is this black male and this dog, are they two lovers? Are they in some sort of sexual, what they call romantic arrangement? The mind of white man and woman. Let's see. Even Keys pointed out, and I think he last week when he said he was White Dog's house nigger, and Romaine Gary got all offended, but I thought that was accurate. This week he says they're good niggers and bad niggers for him. Now they all just niggers, but some of them, oh, he's all right. I won't chomp on this nigger. He feeds me all right. I'll hang out with him. They got little niggers. Remember last week they got little bite-sized niggers. I don't mess with them either. They're too tiny. I don't even mess with them. Let's see. The smell recognizes on people. I thought that was important. And even that, this black male having the audacity to tell him, you know, don't come around here. It's confusing the dog, trying to get him retrained. We don't need you around here messing it up. Like, what? What? Let's see. I also thought that was great as well. When Keys asks him directly, are you going to give me the dog? And he says, oh. A direct challenge. Mo and Dallas pointed that out. A yes or a no. In fact, he says, it hits upon a secret flaw, some oriental trait. Now, at the time this book was published, 1970, that would have been no problem. Oriental, yeah, oriental food, oriental trait, oriental rug, blah, blah, blah. Now, 50 years later, a number of white people say, whoa, that is a little racist. You got to get that out. What do you mean, oriental trait? What are you talking about? Oriental trait? So something that is a defect or a character flaw is associated with oriental non-whiteness. And his flaw is being asked things directly. Can you be direct? Don't confuse me. Don't lie to me. Just be straight with me. Oh, I got a yellow streak there. I got an oriental streak. Oh, I'm not good with that. Let's see. Chapter 16. Now he says, he's talking about this Clara chick. He says, she's known among black extremists, whatever that is, Negro militant, as a nigger lover. This stinking term coined by whites is now used at least as often by blacks. Now he doesn't even explain, what does this term mean exactly? Do they mean the same thing when they say nigger lover? Because I know when white people say nigger lover, that is, you are about to not get this movie part. In fact, you might not take another breath on this planet if we decide you are a nigger lover. They talk about that. They'll talk about those two white boys and James Chaney in the summer of 64, Mississippi. They'll say that. Call them nigger lovers. They'll go, Viola Louisa, they'll point out a bunch of them. Oh, yeah, she was a nigger lover. 68, she was killed the same time, 68. And they'll say she's a nigger lover. When racists, the people, as he said, who created this term, whites, they mean a white person who has somehow violated the racist code. You're not mistreating niggers as we have stated you should. Now, from the context of this reading, it sounds like that when the so-called black extremists are using the term nigger lover, it sounds like it might mean a race soldier who is engaged in some sort of sexual activity with a non-white person. It sounds like it might be a totally different term, but he didn't do all that. And in fact, it just immediately shifted from all of this is a response to racist man and racist woman to we got these black extremists out here calling kind, beautiful people like Clara, calling her nigger lovers. Right. Let's see. So at first, Clara had a code. No messing around. Sex, the listener wrote in, I agree. Hey, every white person should be the same way. There's nothing that we need to get in that bedroom for. Everybody should come up and announce that from the very beginning and then proceed with business. Now we're getting serious about addressing this problem. She doesn't stick to that code. And he comes in with all this nonsense, and one of our listeners pointed that out, saying that, hey, she'd been you can't live and work shoulder to shoulder with men you admire for their tenacity. They're not men. I don't care what they're doing. They're not men. Blocking off any normal relationship between man and a woman, again, we're not a man, and she would know that. I don't care how courageous they are. I don't care if it's Dr. King, Stokely Carmichael, Fred Hampton, H. Rapp Brown, any of these folks. They're not men. Trying hard to be, but not yet. Still would be incorrect. Clara finally took a black lover, even the use of that term, that's in the word, that's why Mr. Fuller, we call sexual intercourse anything, a black lover. She loved him? Really? Then another. So now this becomes a serial act. So we start out with the code. This doesn't need to happen at all. And now I'm involved in serial black loving, so-called. The fact that they were black was totally irrelevant. Uh-oh. I don't think she even noticed at that point that they were. Now, come on. Come on now. Did she go blind at some point? Come on now. Let's see. Continuing, she says, living and working with people, you lose all awareness of the color of skin. You're a total lie, Romaine Gary, as you are known to be. If you live in France, you don't come back home saying, I met a Frenchman. I'd be saying, I met a white man in France or a white woman. But there was a period in the years following the murder of Malcolm X when fanaticism in a political vacuum began to border on paranoia and imbecility, like all fanaticism. That was, historically, when white liberals were first under attack from the militant. Now, look at that. Look at that. Like, we're in a system of white supremacy, but the white liberals were under attack from the militants, no doubt the black extremists. We got that problem today, black identity extremists. And in certain quarters, word went out to use white sympathizers, but never forget they were enemies. Where did the word come from? This is a really powerful white man, Romaine Gary. We'll see that in the chapter 19 that we're about to read. Where did this information come from? The word was given. Isn't that a name of one of the books that we talked about? The word was given. Use the white sympathizer. This is the gaming whitey memo that went out, I guess. Come on. Then I just needed to keep reading my highlight. That was the beginning of gaming whitey, and it is now as dead strategically as Carmichael. Where is that class at? Did they have books? Did they have literature on gaming whitey? Was anybody especially skilled at gaming whitey? Like, can you game whitey out of a jet plane, a mansion, a 12-bedroom house? Like, who are the people that are really good at gaming whitey? Anyway, rejecting white liberals and cutting off your nose to spite your face is a form of scorpioness. Self-hate, that's like a lot of metaphors. Scorpionesque, cutting out, what? Smacks of neurotic love of a tragedy for tragedy's sake, and with Leroy Jones' talent, cowbell. Now, he changed his name to Mary Baraka, passed away in 2014. I would have to go back and double-check. He may have still been married to a white woman at the time this was written. If not, it would be really close to when they got divorced. But cowbell nonetheless. And he even wrote about this same thing, white women engaged in sexual intercourse with black people. Anyway, let's see. He says, after the traditional 15 minutes of the latest police brutalities, I thought white people were ignorant about the police terrorizing black people. So 50 years ago, it was old hat. It was cliche. Oh, hey, how's everybody doing? How's your mom? Did you hear what the police did to Rodney King? Oh, did you hear what they did to Michael Brown? Oh, did you hear what they did to okay, so that's been going on for 50. Got it. Why people are not ignorant about racism, what I've been saying. And what they have been saying about what they been saying about Ron Coringa, and they have a lot to say. There comes the painful moment. Just much I could say about Ron Coringa, victim of racism. I think he is credited with creating Kwanzaa. Yeah, much just, anyway, victim of racism, continuing. Let's see. Good Doctor Abernathy proceeds to describe at length the last moments he spent in the motel room he shared with Martin Luther King at the time of his murder. Something about, I guess some people do refer to him as Martin Luther King, but I'm just accustomed to Junior. He had a father by the same name, Senior. There's no doctor. Just seems like not a whole lot of regard for Dr. King, even in the moments after his assassination. Not a whole lot of regard for black people in general, so this is just, you know, a part of the same pattern. Continuingly, a pathetically sincere attempt, intolerable in its naivete, a burning and yet ineffectual desire to confer upon the last moments an aura of biblical light and immortality, transforming the murderous savagery of the deed into a second-rate crucifixion devoid of the narrative genius of the apostles. Like, really? Like, I think a lot of people to this day do still talk about this as a crucifixion of sort. That is the exact metaphor that is still used, and very fitting, I think, even more so today. So white people and non-white people, not that I'm into Christian metaphors, religion of white supremacy, but I mean lots of, particularly when they go back and look at his speech from the day before, because we got our sick white brothers. He didn't say our sick black brothers. He wasn't worried about it. We got people out here, these Negroes like Stokely Carmichael calling me a sellout and a coon. I'm worried they might kill me. He was worried about our sick white brothers and sisters. Many people describe it in that way. So as the reader talked about, wrote in, the way that he is describing the Poor People's Campaign, I'm not necessarily, you know, a fan of that and thinking that that's what to do, but that was something that Dr. King was very passionate about, and that was one of the last projects that he was working on at the time of his death. So if they're trying to carry it out in his name, to sit around as some white man, some suspected racist, and I'm just going to sit around and mock them. Oh, this is so stupid, lame, and dumb. Well, what should we do, Romaine Gay, other than sit around and write books about your racist dog? What should we do? If you don't have anything other than we're going to sit around and talk bad about all the black people, about how dumb and stupid Stokely Carmichael is and Dr. Abernathy, if that's all we're going to do, and how many teeth Keyes has in his head, I'm good. Sit down. I'd rather listen to the folks with the Poor People Campaign. Let's see. I had lots more notes, but we have more reading to get to. So I will pause and we will – man, I had lots more notes. Yeah, we'll pause and go ahead and get to the rest. As a matter of fact, the last one I'll get in, because he said it twice. He said it before. He thought Coretta Scott King looked so beautiful after Dr. King's assassination. And I said something struck me as really incorrect, really necrophilia, about a white man making that sort of comment, how beautiful a black female looks in mourning the assassination of her husband. And then he comes back and says it again, or it's only a few days after he's been buried, to come back, oh, she just looks so beautiful. That's how black people look gorgeous and beautiful, when they're suffering the greatest terrorism, greatest loss of her life, loss of her children's father. And oh, she just looks so, get out of here. Get out of here. We'll get to the second audio segment. This is a powerful white man. That's all I'll say. You can just pay attention to the second audio segment. This is a powerful suspected race soldier, Gary Romaine. Context of white supremacy. If you have comments that you did not get to share, make a note, and we'll have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. The Cows Book Club will get to Gary Romaine, White Dog, audio segment number two.
Chapter 19. Back at Arden, I find a message from Nicole Salinger. Bobby Kennedy is taking 2 days off from his campaign against McCarthy. He asks us to meet him in Malibu at John Frankenheimer's home. I knew his brother when the latter was a senator and had seen him again at the White House a few months before the assassination, but I had never met Bobby. The press says he can already count on 90% of the black vote in California, but Gene instantly begins to bubble with plans. If we could arrange a meeting between Bobby, a moderate like Brooker, and a radical like Red. She gathers her literature, complete with the Montessori School Without Hate brochure, and lets Brooker know about the possibility. I phone Red in Washington at first meet with refusal, then he decides to come and arrives that night. I find him nervous and ill at ease, insecure, as they say here. Since King's murder, the air is so thick with poison that a black power leader who agrees even to talk with the white establishment feels as if he were betraying, collaborating, as the French resistance referred to those who cooperated with the Germans. I have never seen him like that. Studious-looking, his glasses pushed up on his forehead and a pile of papers in his lap. He spends some time fulminating against the Kennedys, who haven't done a thing and know nothing about us, then comes up with some ideas that I found crazy at the time. I have since thought better of them after reading a couple of well-documented books about the power, both financial and political, of the Mafia, with one of the authors, a distinguished professor, actually suggesting that the only way to preserve the political integrity of the nation is to negotiate with the mafioso and draw up some kind of treaty with them. Red's words ring with a passion, a resentment that, for the first time since I have known him, fill me with the malaise I always experience when a man's voice is more like blood gushing from a deep, opened wound. The crime and union complex has always kept us blacks out of both unions and organized crime, same thing, which explains a lot about our situation today. The unions keep us off jobs and we don't have the financial power to exert pressure. The FBI kid gloves the crime-led unions because that keeps unions non-political. You can bet they prefer a criminal leadership to a political one. It keeps any threat of socialism away. Nobody is more conservative than hoods. The mafia union complex bars our people because that puts the mafia right with the establishment and the unions, with the blue-collar class. The Italian, Jewish, and Irish minorities gained equality status by organizing pressure groups, but until then, poor immigrants, the white niggers, had to resort to organized crime like all have-nots who aren't given a chance. I think the moment's come to force the mafia to give up its position to us, and we can achieve that without too much difficulty by striking at the top. There's nothing but old men up there, and the young ones are too fat. I try to look at Red as if I were taking him seriously, but then there was at least one thing truly serious, overwhelmingly so, in these ravings, a quality of despair. Toward 2 o'clock in the morning, he admits, Bobby is the only one we might possibly trust. McCarthy is all rhetoric. Blacks are a theoretical problem for him. He gives it to me in French. Un trop populo pour lui. We're too much a mass for him. He can't see a face to it. I yawn. Listen, McCarthy himself is strictly a theoretical issue. He can't make it. How's Philip? A flicker of a smile, but enough for me to catch the expression of pride. He's been made an officer. Got a couple more medals. You would think you were listening to a Law and Order father talking about his patriotic hero of a son. He gets hold of himself, comes back to the point. He'll be back home in a month or so. Before Vietnam is over, we'll have 50,000 black fighters, the real thing, ready to make their voice heard, and oh boy, that's going to be some voice. Above all, what they'll give the revolution is discipline. That's what we need most. Too much individualism, parading, jockeying for leadership positions, and nothing in terms of organization, coherent action. The big blow-up? Not necessarily so. I'm thinking in terms of a political force, something like the unions 50 years ago when they really began to get at the boss's throat. Marginally, a takeover of mafia strongholds. If American-style political pressure fails, then we'll reappraise. It's equal rights or else. I don't say we can achieve victory by violence. That's poetry. But there are enough of us to make America impossible, and that ought to make America possible. Are you going to tell all this to Bobby? Damn right. I'll give it to him right in the eye. I couldn't take it anymore. The plan, the hope, the projects themselves, all right, it made some sense, and maybe more than some. But how the hell could he ignore the fact that his son was a genuine American hero? Was he pretending? Was he cheating on me, on his son, or on himself? Deliberate self-delusion to spare himself a break with the son he loved so much. When the moment of truth came a few months later, on that yellow lamp-lit staircase on Arden, I was to blame myself bitterly for my irritated, even hostile, prying into the heart and mind of a man who, in a less insane world, would have been a magnificent American leader, second to none in our time. But right then, I was boiling with frustrated common sense. The man was deeply practical, a pragmatist, with a typical, traditional, grassroots horse sense. Yet the rejection and the denial, the negation of his deep Americanism, of his devouring American dynamism and need for accomplishment, for meeting the challenge victoriously, was shifting him from reality into the realm of the imaginary, a commander-in-chief of an army of the future, consumed by an almost mythological dream of power and greatness, a dream bordering on the fantastic with its roots deep within the very soul of Africa with its magic, sorcerers, and legendary kings. His face had that calm and self-assured mask so often worn by those who are much closer to a dream than to reality. Who was it who had first coined the expression logical delirium? I hesitate briefly, but then the urge to bring him back to earth, to sanity, is stronger than the wish to spare him. You know that Ballard wants to come back to the States? He's one of those guys like Cleaver who can't adjust to a life away from home. He can't take Europe. He's too American, I guess. His face closes, lock, stock, and barrel. You can almost hear the key. All that is left is an air of disdain and detachment. He shrugs. Un pauvre con. A jackass. one of those hippie types that mushroom out of this country's rot. We don't need freaks like him here. There's too many of them as it is. A trace of uneasiness, and then he betrays himself. He's better off in France. Tell him that. He doesn't much like the thought that Ballard will be treated as a deserter in America. He avoids my eyes and repeats, "For God's sake, tell that idiot to stay in Paris." I will. Jean and I drove to Malibu the next morning. Bobby Kennedy was in the ocean, and all I could see was his hair floating over the waves. The waves were rough, and he seemed to enjoy that. He came into the living room a few minutes later, wearing a pair of Bermuda shorts, his chest bare, and sat cross-legged on the floor. Jean grabbed her briefcase and brought out her papers. He laughed, shaking his head, raising his arms before his face in a mocking gesture of self-defense. "Hey, I'm taking a day off." He listened attentively all the same and promised to talk both to Red and to Brooker. Then he squatted on the floor once more between Nicole Salinger and me. A few days earlier, Paul Ziffrin, the former Democratic Party head in California, had asked me to write down my views on the problem as seen by a foreigner, an outsider's reaction. I didn't write the report because I am unable to feel an outsider anywhere, least of all in America. Neither do I feel capable of objectivity when I come face to face with injustice and race prejudice. Call me a naturally biased writer and leave it at that. But I was amazed by the idea of the Republic of New Africa, a black Israel in the South, a messianic dream that I kept hearing about. I mentioned this to Bobby, who shot back immediately. Unthinkable. Absurd. This kind of intellectual defeatism amounts to a capitulation of democracy. Yes, an unconditional surrender of the American democratic ideal. Just good for today's usual apocalyptic talk. To reach that point, it would take a worldwide nuclear cataclysm, total anarchy for years, the sort of thing they had in Europe when the plague wiped out 60% of the population. He was sitting cross-legged, a glass of orange juice in hand. There was something about his body that made you think of the big, clumsy feet of young dogs. The boyishness and the charm were so much more apparent than the supposed ruthlessness. I was thinking that these features, round, fleshy, and delicate at the same time, these unruly locks were in the mainstream of American faces, the Will Rogers kind, and when age and white hair come, he would look a bit like Cordell Hull or Wilson of General Motors and Capital fame. 2 weeks before, I had told Pierre Salinger at the Ziffrins, "You know, of course, that your guy will be killed." Salinger froze, staring at me for a long time. Then he said, "I live with that fear. We do what can be done, and that isn't much. He runs around like Quicksilver." Mickey Ziffrin asked me, "Why? Why do you think so?" Folklore, the emulation race, the competition, a taste for the happening and the I can do better. Since Jack's assassination, Bobby represents an irresistible temptation for the average American paranoid personality, the psycho-contagion of deeply traumatic events with its craving for more of the same. And another thing, Bobby is too much. He is a constant challenge, a provocation for any man with a paranoid grudge, tortured both by his desire to assert himself and by his feeling of non-existence. Bobby is too rich, too young, too attractive, too happy, too lucky, too powerful, too successful. He arouses in every persecuted type a deep sense of injustice. He acts on such a person the way a luxury store window display acts upon a destitute Harlem kid, or in the way the exhibitionism of American wealth acts upon the underdeveloped countries. Bobby is too much. It would be grotesque if I patted myself complacently on the back for predicting it. I am compelled to report this incident because it raises an important element in any spectrum analysis of today's America. This country, which is in the forefront of almost everything, including excess, is also in the forefront of neurosis. This immense technological disturbing machine processes people's lives the way it processes other goods, with an overall concern for productivity, usefulness, and rentability, which is the best way to crush people into non-existence in terms of human values, personality, self-respect, and self-realization. Living becomes an empty bureaucratic ritual, endlessly self-repeating, and the call of nature, never quite suppressed, becomes a basic, elemental one that is the call of violence. In such a situation, the need for self-liberation cannot become anything else but violence, as in all relationships between freedom and a social straitjacket. The suppressed individual either transfers his individuality upon a group. The modern group tends to be more and more a sublimated, multiplied I, and then runs amok with the group, or if too much alienated for this recourse, asserts himself in the most shock-provoking way he can find, in the hope that the greatness of the bang will assert and express the greatness of his I. The threat of this American paranoia lay heavily on Bobby. In this country, where the cult of success accentuates more than anywhere else the feelings of failure and inferiority, paranoia is perhaps no more prevalent than elsewhere, but certainly more apparent and dangerous, as the American temptation to prove yourself a success all too often seeks release in the dramatic, the shocking, and the awe-inspiring. I asked Bobby what precautions he was taking after the precedent, as he referred to it. He shrugged, shook his head. There's no way of protecting a country stumping candidate. No way at all. You've just got to give yourself to the people and to trust them, and from then on it's just that good old bitch luck. He laughed, toyed with the dregs of his orange juice, and that boyish forelock fell down on his forehead in the way America will long remember it. Anyway, you have to have luck on your side to be elected President of the United States. Either it's with you or it isn't. I am pretty sure there'll be an attempt on my life sooner or later. Not so much for political reasons. I don't believe that. Plain nuttiness. That's all. There's plenty of that around. We live in a time of extraordinary psychic contagion. Maybe the contagion has always been at work as far back as you can look, but with mass media, it's become instantaneous. Because a guy kills Martin Luther King here, some other type catches the bug in Berlin and tries to kill that German student leader, what's his name? Someone should make a study of the traumatizing effect caused by mass media, which dwells on and lives by drama and creates in turn a psychological need, almost an addiction, for dramatic events until the whole thing keeps snowballing on and on. A chain reaction. And there's the overpopulation, the demographic congestion in cities with people rubbing and bumping against each other. There's been an experiment with, I don't remember what kind of animals, and it proved that when animals are not given enough living space, they go mad and jump at each other's throats. People feel so repressed, you can see that in the ghettos, they literally explode. With the young, the need for violence is often a creative urge, and if you haven't got a way to express it artistically, no talent, well, I guess you just make a happening in the street. Not to mention the spiritual void, though you know people can be murderous about their beliefs too. And there's Hemingway. I admired Hemingway as a writer, but he's the one who started that myth about the virility that goes with firearms and with the beauty of killing animals or enemies. It's been absolutely impossible to get a law through Congress banning the unrestricted sale of firearms. We talk about the students putting colleges throughout the country in a state of siege. His first reaction is typical of a man who is first of all a politician. He begins to speak figures and votes. The impact of the new young voters won't be much felt in the 1972 elections. He says this with a half mischievous, half embarrassed smile, as if both slightly apologetic and yet ruthless in his realistic approach. Then he adds, I can't help feeling a bit reticent toward students. Is it because they are, by and large, for Eugene McCarthy? I don't ask him this suspicion, but he confirms it as if he had guessed my thoughts. I leave certain university circles to McCarthy. I don't have much use for them, frankly. The sort of thing that's going on right now at Columbia makes it out of the question for me to come out on the side of young people just because they are young. That's no specific kind of credit or reference in itself. It depends on what you do with it, with being young, I mean. What you're about. I'm all for dissent if it means articulate, coherent criticism and debate. But at Columbia, as was the case in Berkeley last year, it is exactly the kind of behavior that starts all the things they are protesting against. Vietnam came out of violence, so violence is the first thing you've got to be against. They're tearing down the campus because they can't do a thing about freeing that writer, Sienavinsky, in Russia, or stopping the war in Vietnam. But that's like smashing glassware when you get mad. It's a release, not action. There were ominous rumbles coming from the streets of Paris, with de Gaulle still on a state visit to Romania, and Kennedy asked me several concerned questions about France. Was de Gaulle letting the situation go deliberately out of hand so that the opposition would be lulled into a false feeling of power and overplay its hand? I told him I had no answer, but in France, as almost everywhere, the young generation was refusing to fall like insert one coin into prefabricated slots of society designed to distribute people from job to job until old age or retirement. Discontented as the kids were with the reception committee, that is, with the society awaiting them, and as sincere as they were in their desire for a change, what was important and apparent was their determination to build something with their own hands, a creative refusal to accept the world of others. Anyway, de Gaulle is the last of his kind, Bobby said. There'll never be another like him. Do you think the way we treated him during the war explains his present attitude toward the Anglo-Saxon world? His brother had asked me exactly the same question 5 years earlier. It was true that Roosevelt and Churchill had given de Gaulle a lesson in power he had never forgotten. Through them, he discovered that the word France didn't have a magical ring in the ears of his partners when it was no longer accompanied by the sound of power. Just how many attempts on his life has he survived exactly? 6 or 7, I think. He shook his head and laughed. I told you, luck. You can't make it without that good old bitch, luck. It was over. Present were two of his aides, Dick Goodwin and Pierre Salinger, Salinger's wife, Nicole, Angie Dickinson, and her husband, Bert Baccarat, Alan J. Lerner, and Karen, Warren Beatty, and John Frankenheimers, the astronaut Glenn, 3 or 4 other people on Kennedy's staff whose names I didn't catch. Before we left, he promised Jean to speak with Brooker and Red that very day. He kept his promise. Red called me that evening from the airport. I asked him rather nervously, "How did it go?" I can tell he's trying to sound indifferent, to play it cool. You can't trust any presidential candidate. They'll promise anything. Well, this being said, he's the only one. There's no other. He checks himself. But that doesn't mean a word more than I'm saying. There's no other. Period. We'll judge him on what he does, not on what he says.
Context of white supremacy. That'll wrap up our second audio segment. We'll pick up next week on chapter 20. Got thrown off a little bit. I was so excited. Timing has been pretty amazing throughout reading this text. So I'm just digging this in really quick. They talked a lot about the assassination of Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, during this week's section, and giving their reason for why one or both of these guys might be killed. There are other theories as to why either of the Kennedys would be killed.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Real problem is this, James. In 2 decades, there will be 7 billion human beings on this planet. Most of them brown, yellow, or black. All of them hungry. All of them determined to love. Swarm out of their breeding grounds into Europe and North America. Hence Vietnam. An all-out effort there will give us control of South Asia for decades to come. And with proper planning, we can reduce the population to 550 million by the end of the century. I know. I've seen the data.
We sound rather like gods reading the Doomsday Book, don't we?
Well, someone has to do it. Not only will the nations affected be better off, but the techniques developed there can be used to reduce our own excess population. Blacks, Puerto Ricans, Mexican Americans, poverty-prone whites, and so forth.
Context of white supremacy. We even got the commercial in from Mr. Edward Williams, counter-racism.com, but that is from the film Executive Action. That is Hollywood. You know, that's not a documentary. Came out about 50 years ago, but ooh-wee. That is a very different theory as to why the Kennedys, and that's what that movie is all about, the Kennedy assassination, and why we would need to do this, because we want a war in Vietnam. JFK did not want that. Seems his brother may have been opposed to that, too. Justification to kill both of them. We got to kill these non-white people. And he even mentioned population tailoring. Demographics. Don't want all these non-white people breeding, hopping all over here. I thought I heard that in the book. And I think I'm hearing that right now. Complaint. Got all these non-white people hopping over the border, raping people. FOMO years. The number is 717-206-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you did not get to speak at all, you didn't get to share anything during the first audio segment, definitely get your hand up right now. Do not wait until the last few minutes if you have commentary to share. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. I'll look out, see if there are any folks that we missed totally, to see if they have commentary to share.
Can I be heard again?
Let's see. Any thoughts, folks? Anything stood out, second audio?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes. They were talking about, it seemed as though they were talking about the inefficiency of Robert Kennedy's security. Just for, if anyone didn't know, two of his bodyguards were non-white black males. They certainly weren't professionals, but they were world-class athletes. Rafer Johnson, 1956, silver medalist, gold medalist in 1960, and Rosie Greer, who played for the New York Giants and the Los Angeles Rams, that he kept around him all the time, especially during that presidential campaign. Matter of fact, they were there at his assassination, wrestling the gun away from the assassin at the time when he was murdered in Los Angeles, California, which was approximately 2 months to the day after the date that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered. Just some information additional to the book. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Any other folks comments to share? Second audio segment.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I think this is Mo in Dallas.
Yes, it is. I have two notes that I wrote. One is, what it says, there have been an experiment with animals. I don't know what kind. When you cage them, they jump at each other's throats. I think that's it sounded to me like it stood out because it sounded like an inside joke about non-white people, black people. And you can see that in, like, you know, these highly condensed areas and in urban communities where they're stacked on top of each other, and there's a, you know, a large amount of violence. And you can also see the same sort of behavior in, like, prisons. And he did say when you put them in cages, and or you know, prisons or greater confinement. And this quote, Vietnam came out of violence. So violence is the first thing that you should be against. I thought that was very interesting because you can substitute the word America for Vietnam, and you can turn that quote into America came out of violence, so violence is the first thing that you should be against. Or you can substitute America for Vietnam, and you can substitute violence for white supremacy. And the statement would be, America came out of white supremacy, so white supremacy is the first thing that you should be against. And all of those statements rang true, so it just rung to me, so I wrote them down. Well, that's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. Let's see, I'm going to sneak in one of our investors' written commentary he emailed in. From chapter 19, number 1, conversation with Bobby Kennedy, author, but I was amazed by the idea of the Republic of New Africa, a black Israel in the south of a, in the south, a Masonic dream that I kept hearing about. I mentioned this to Bobby, who shot back immediately, unthinkable, absurd. This kind of intellectual defeatism amounts to a capitulation of democracy, yes, an unconditional surrender of our democratic ideal. Apocalyptic talk. It would take a worldwide cataclysm, total anarchy. The word democracy and democratic ideals should be replaced with the global system of racism, white supremacy. Absolutely. Stop lying. And I even want to pause. Bobby Kennedy, we talk about COINTELPRO on here. Bobby Kennedy was Attorney General, signed off on wiretaps for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other black people, probably some of the members of the Black Panther Party, probably Kwame Ture as well, Stokely Carmichael, at that time, before he was running for office in 68 and eventually assassinated. He was, while his brother was president, holding attorney general. That's a pretty lofty position, right? COINTELPRO. Not just J. Edgar Hoover, Justice Department, Attorney General. That's part of the Justice Department, all of that. Couldn't do anything about racist killing black people and the rest of it, but, oh, man, we can spy on Dr. King. Let's see if we can. Number two, author, 2 weeks before, I had told Pierre Salinger at the Ziffrins, you know, of course, that guy will be killed. Salinger froze, staring at me. Given the events of the times, assassination of his brother, JFK and Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, I don't think this was such a prescient statement. Exactly. I was going to say that frickin' Jim Garrison, who was the attorney, a prosecuting attorney in New Orleans, Louisiana, predicted that Kennedy was going to be Robert Kennedy was going to be assassinated. There was lots of people who had said that by then. You had all kinds of folks dying every day, not to mention Vietnam in the background. I mean, big whoop. They, I forgot, the former governor of Alabama, George Wallace. He was running in 68. He almost got assassinated. I mean, big deal. So what? He tried to kill somebody out in public. That's almost the air now. So what? You killed one person. Like, you have to kill about 50 people for it to be news now. Number three, RFK. I admired Hemingway as a writer, but he's the one who started the myth about virility that goes with firearms and with the beauty of killing animals or enemies. This statement is inaccurate. Firearms are foundational to the United States of America, and the symbolism of the Great Equalizer was discussed by Dr. Welsing. I, too, thought that was absurd. Like, really? Really? Anyway, number four, conversation with Kennedy. Red called me that evening from the airport. You can't trust any presidential candidate. They'll promise anything. We'll judge him on what he does, not on what he says. As is often remarked on this program, white people can show you better than they can tell you. Absolutely. Just watch what they do. Anywho, let's see. Any other folks commentary they wanted to get in? I'll see if I can read a few of my notes. I'll check the line as well, see if folks have any other comments. Before we wrap things up, remember, do not wait till the end if you think you have a comment to get in. Let's see. So going to 19, as I said, Romaine Gary is a powerful white man. I don't know too many people who can say that they, you know, have sat and talked with the president, sat and talked with the attorney general, sat and talked with the president, and then came, sat and talked with somebody who was running for president, who actually had a chance to win, like not some fringe candidate, you know, Ross Perot or something like that, but somebody who could actually win. Wow. Powerful white man. He's not even a U.S. citizen. I mean, a U.S. citizen couldn't even get a sit down with Robert Kennedy. They got him hanging out, jumping in the pool and such. System of white supremacy. So let's see. Chapter 19. So he's talking about this proposed meeting. He's going to have Red come and chat it up with Bobby Kennedy. He says, I find Red nervous and ill at ease, insecure, as they say here, a black person nervous in a system of white supremacy. Imagine that. Since King's murder, the air is so thick with poison that a black power leader, black power. Now, I don't recall having heard the word white power in this book at all. We got black extremists, black racists, now black power. A black power leader, all of the leaders of black people are white. But a black power leader, all kinds of oxymoron, who agrees even to talk with the white establishment. Now, he doesn't have black power in quotes. He has it capitalized as though it's that professional and serious. Then he has white establishment, white in lowercase lettering, and in quotes. The white establishment feels as if he were betraying, collaborating, as the French resistance referred to those who cooperated with the Germans. I can understand why that might be the case at that time period, given that a white person, not black people who hated King, killed Dr. King. I can understand why it might be, wow, I'm not feeling talking to these white people about anything right about now. Continuing, he says, so he, I guess, is downplaying the mafia, the mob, as they call it. The mob, the greatest gangsters in the known universe, white people, the system of white supremacy. You want to talk about gangsters? There you go. Let's see. So he is doing all this quoting of Red. Incidentally, a white person, a powerful white person who is meeting with presidents and traveling all over the world and powerful movie stars and Marlon Brando, the Godfather, for Christ's sake, like, you're hanging out with all these people, Harry Belafonte and Coretta Scott King, and you're going to sit here and quote some confused victim. I say white people do that all the time. They will find some confused non-white person, and since 99.99% of non-white people in the known universe do not understand the system of white supremacy, it's not hard to find a non-white person talking nonsense about the system. So, yeah. Red's ideas, this probably is accurate. I think I've heard some non-white people who were talking this way. All of this is nonsense. We're going to go in it. You hear non-white people talking that way now. We just need to go and get our guns. We're going to show them. All of that is nonsense. You, as a white man, you know this is nonsense. Why are you quoting all of this in the book? Is it to mock black people? Why is all of this here? What problem are you trying to solve by quoting all of this from Red? Is this realism? Like you just want to show, be authentic and reveal, you know, what's happening with black people, the dumb thoughts that they have? Okay. Continuing, all of that, white people being to blame, but all right, continuing. Let's see. So he says, a commander-in-chief of an army of the future, talking about Red, consumed by an almost mythological dream of power and greatness, a dream bordering on the fantastic with its roots deep within the very soul of Africa, with its magic, sorcerers, and legendary kings. Something about that just smacks of that same mocking that we heard before when he was comparing the black people having on their African garb and such to having facial piercings and things in their lip and all the rest of it. Just the way that he talks about black people throughout the book, I mean, from paragraph to paragraph, sentence to sentence, it is exactly what I would expect from a white man, white woman, white child, dedicated to white supremacy, racism, and someone who thinks very little. You're not human beings. You're some kind of subspecies. That's how he talks about even Dr. King, all of them. Let's see. When he said, this is Romaine Gary talking, he says, neither do I feel capable of objectivity when I come face to face with injustice and race prejudice, not racism. Call me a naturally biased writer and leave it at that, but I was amazed by the idea of the Republic of New Africa, a black Israel in the South. Now, he was amazed by it. Is it you're amazed by it because you understand black people are being mistreated and you're amazed that this is the only way possible, or this is even a solution that's being proposed? Why is that amazing? This problem has been going on for so many years. Why is that amazing? Not that I think it's going to happen, not even realistic, but I'm not amazed. Just trying to think of something, being terrorized here. Let's see. Drag racing continues. Yeah, that's what I said. Romaine Gary, this book is in my top 10, but it's not well written. And Romaine Gary, he's talking about narcissistic, self-absorbed, egotistic whites. He is talking about himself. He says it would be grotesque if I patted myself complacently on the back for predicting Robert Kennedy's assassination. Well, why even say it? And as I said, this is 1960. You got people dying every day. And Vietnam, the same thing. You got a death toll on the TV every day. How many slopes and slant-eyes they have killed in Southeast Asia. That's every day. And they had the Hong Kong flu happened at the time, too, so it's exactly the same. Every day. No big deal. Killing people all the time, political reasons, no reasons, bombing buildings, the weathermen running around killing folks. This is all day long, every day. Let's see. Same as we got now, Dylann Roof and all the rest. I thought it was fascinating in a book called White Dog, all this attention on dogs. Robert Kennedy twice says you just got to give yourself to the people and trust them, and from then on it's just that old bitch luck. I have never heard to luck referred to as that good old bitch. White people and their dogs. He says it twice. Next. Overpopulation. I played that segment. What did they say in executive action? The non-white people, brown people, and black people will have too many of them. They'll swarm and overpopulate their areas and come over here and rape our white women. Four more years. He says there's the overpopulation, the demographic congestion in the cities with people rubbing and bumping against each other. Almost made some sound sexual for a second. That right there, anytime I hear a white person talking about population control, overpopulation, that sort of thing on the planet, I don't need to hear anything else. That is a long history of genetic eugenics, population tailoring, and explicit white supremacy racism. Almost invariably, the people that they're talking about with overpopulation are non-white people. You never hear them say, man, we got to go up to Vermont. It's too many white people. We got to go into Sweden. It's just too many white people. Europe, all that. France. Too many white people. That's never what they're talking about. It's always with Planned Parenthood. I mean, this document, they got document Maafa 21 and Margaret Sanger and all the rest of it, well documented. We've done programs on this. But anytime a white person comes onto this, and on a planet where you have an abundance, where white people waste all kinds of resources and brag about wasting resources, to come out and have the audacity to have someone who's a presidential candidate serious one at that. Oh, man, overpopulation. Demographic. Which demographics, Bobby Kennedy? And he says, he comes down, he says, when you got animals that don't have enough living space and all that, blah, 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 yeah, yeah. That's not the problem here. The problem here is not overcrowding. It's white supremacy. People feel so repressed. You can see that in the ghettos. What? Come on. Come on. Let's see. Yeah, the whole line about the guns. Now, even that is fascinating because a lot of that, we can't get any firearm reform because we got the Black Panthers running around who they have mocked repeatedly in the text and saying they're just all this violent rhetoric and they don't do anything. They're no action. Wow. Ronald Reagan, J. Edgar Hoover certainly didn't feel that way. They took them very seriously, seriously enough that they changed and strengthened gun laws because of them. They didn't think they were a joke. Let's see. I think the kind of minimal mention of Vietnam, Romain Gary brags about being a Frenchman. The United States got involved in Vietnam because of France's ineptitude in controlling the dark people in that part of the world. He's talking about racism, white supremacy, as though that is local just to here. France's involvement in Vietnam is all white supremacy, racism on a global level. And at this very time, France in Algiers, I forgot all about that, on the continent. That is racism, white supremacy. They still got their whole colonial struggle going on. And get out of here and fighting with them and get off the continent and all the rest of it. And he's talking as though this racism thing is just, oh, this is just a U.S. thing. You all, we don't have this. Get out of here, Romain Gary. He continues, I thought this was one of the more fascinating lines this week. Robert Kennedy talking. He says, anyway, De Gaulle is the last of his kind. Bobby said there'll never be another like him. Do you think the way we treated him during the war explains his present attitude toward the Anglo-Saxon world? Wow. What does that mean? What is the, I mean, I thought white people were ignorant about racism, but the Anglo-Saxon world? What? And he does have Anglo-Saxon in capital letters here. But what? What does that mean? What was De Gaulle's attitude toward the Anglo-Saxon world circa 1968. Like, I would like a whole lot more detail. And even conversation like that, because he wasn't saying we got population problems, overcrowding in the Anglo-Saxon world. That's not what he said. He said it was in the urban centers, in the city. Generally, we know who that's code for, not the Anglo-Saxon world. He says his brother had asked me the exact same question 5 years earlier. That's what double, are you serious? The whole Kennedy family is sitting around wondering, what is Charles de Gaulle thinking about the Anglo-Saxon world? Who is it? Am I part of the Anglo-Saxon world? I thought we were in the U.S. That's what they said. I thought we were part of America. Where is the Anglo-Saxon? Is that on the map, the Anglo-Saxon world? Maybe they're talking about the system of white supremacy. What does he think about white people in the world? Maybe that's what it is. Let's see. Anything else? Make sure I get in. Yeah, I'm good. Any other folks' comments they want to make sure they get in?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hi. This is Silent Warrior. I'm calling. It's 4:55 in the morning where I'm at. And I think I'm a bit confused at this point. I'm not too certain where he is lying or he's using other people to spread his own ideas. For example, like Clara and Bobby Kennedy and Red. So it's very useful to hear your input on that. In chapter 15, where Clara is saying that sex with her won't solve racism, I thought two things. One, it sounded as if the author was trying to make a protest against the sex he saw between white and black people during this protest time. And two, it sounded also like something that Dr. Wilson would say, like, sex with white women during a system of white supremacy won't solve the problem. The gathering of Hollywood for fundraising of busing non-whites to the Poor People's March, he made a statement there that, for if there are still wise men around in our time, all they seem to bring in the way of gifts is napalm, tyranny, and bloodshed. Wise men bringing napalm, tyranny, and bloodshed. So here seems to be a reference to the wise men that visit baby Jesus. And it seems as if he's equating wise men with white men. So that refers me back to the major players in Christianity being construed as white. Another quote during that fundraising gathering that he attributed to Jesse Jackson, who says, "Dares to let the cat out of the bag. Generosity, yes, sure. But we can't solve the problem of 20 million black Americans without a change in America." I thought that was really interesting because it seemed as if he was saying that the problem is 20 million black Americans. You know, he didn't say he doesn't say the problems of 20 million black Americans that solve their problems. He says the problem of 20 million black Americans. So I think this quote that he's attributing to Jesse Jackson, I think, is also autobiographical about the way he feels about black Americans. I also got the same as you did on page 173, where he talks about white liberals who use black America's tragedy and its authentic feeling of injustice for pathological reasons of their own. Here he says it's white liberals and militants who do this. But he's equating white people who are practicing racism with black non-white victims of racism. He's equated the possible ineffectiveness of non-white people who are making some kind of protest against racism with white liberals, and I think that is highly inaccurate because none of these black militants, like you said, Gus, have access to Bobby Kennedy. To be hanging out with Bobby Kennedy while he's at the beach. So I don't see that happening. So I don't think the black people had that kind of access on that first level hand of access. So I don't see the equivalent. Columbus's egg. I had to Google what that was about, and it refers to a brilliant idea or discovery that seems easy or simple after the fact. When this white man is saying, like, white men at this fundraising is saying that we must go into black families, have dinner with them once a week, get to know them. I'm thinking, I don't want to be one of the black families that is going to be visited. If that felt very scary, that felt very uncomfortable. I just see a few more fantasizing over black death with his admiration of Coretta Scott King, some more Wilson moments about where he says black Muslims say amongst themselves that white should be castrated. I don't know if that is even true. And if it is, I think that's black people trying to sound tough like white people by doing the same thing that they do in reverse. And I thought it was interesting where this dialogue between the militant and Katzenbolgen, where he says the militant is cussing him out and Katzenbolgen is responding by saying, have a bit more chicken. And then he, in French, calls him, calls the militant, in French, a black shit eater. So it's a lot of mocking there. But then this person who is very...
30 seconds?
This person who seems to be so understanding of people comes to see the author in a couple of days to see if he could get the dog for himself. Because knowing that the dog will attack black people. So I think it's highly revealing of how white liberals behave. It's very revealing of that. So for that, I think it's quite interesting. Thank you.
Silent Warrior joining us live. Get our timestamp a little after 5 a.m. in Norway. Man, early for White Dog. We did our 3 hours, plus a little extra, actually. We'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism and Saturday for the compensatory call-in. We are closing on the finish line of White Dog, even though we still have at least 3 weeks to go, maybe four. But we are getting close to the conclusion, so we can be thinking of other books to read for later on. Anywho, much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening hyphen Friday morning, and we'll be here for next Thursday as we continue Romaine Gary, White Dog. As usual, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism. We will need our thinking brain computers working at maximum efficiency to solve this here problem. No contaminants. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. I still contend, let's hunker down. If you don't have to go out, stay in. It is unsafe, especially here in the U.S. Lots of armed whites. And even non-white people. If you go out, you want to be hyper-vigilant. If it looks like someone is escalating, being violent, hostile, it is time to exit. You do not want to take any unnecessary risks. Given the current situation right now, value your safety, and especially if you're an attempted parent, value offspring's safety. Tell them the same thing. Be mindful of what's happening around you. You're not getting into any spats or verbal altercations with any white people. If it looks like they're getting loud and hostile, time to go. Anywho, you got to go out. It's something serious. You got to be alert, certainly going to be sober. You are buckled if you're in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. And if you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Number one, we got to be paying attention. Number two, let's minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Just doing the little things that we can to minimize contact with officers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Tao signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned. Yeah.